Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. With us today, we have Melanie Nabar. Melanie is a principal at Volition Capital. Melanie, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Christian.
Well, excited to be here. So let's start with Volition. What's the fund's thesis and what's your focus inside the
Happy to share. So Volition, we're a growth equity firm. So that means we come in typically when companies have established some good product market fit. They're no longer just, you know, ideas with one or two customers. They have dozens of customers and they're in scaling mode. And we come in as minority partners, typically putting some cash on the balance sheet to let founders go after building another product or hiring a sales team faster to get to the place they want to be at an increased pace. We also sometimes do chips off the table where a founder has all their net worth tied up in their business and would like to not have to worry about paying their mortgage or something like that. So we'll do some secondary sometimes as well. And the thesis of the firm is that we find great founders and management teams that have big visions, but they are not the type of founders that are looking for the next raise to be their goal. So they're not focused on, oh, I can't wait to be able to put out that flashy press release that says, you know, I raised $100 million. They're focused on building a great business, providing value to their customers, hopefully disrupting a market along the way. But they're doing it in a little bit more of a capital efficient manner. And so they come to us with good vision of exactly what they would want to do with that capital, which obviously reduces kind of the downside risk as we partner. And then because they're going after it with a big vision also increases our upside potential.
Great. And so does that generally translate into Series B or will you guys go down to Series A as well?
Yeah, so we'll do Series A or Series B. It sometimes just depends on whether the company has bootstrapped the business. You know, it could be a Series A with a $30 million check. You've never raised any capital before. Or it could be a Series B with the same size check. But we'll write anything between $15 million on the low end to $75, $80 million on the high end. So pretty big range there.
And then focus on geography or industry.
Yes. So we do North America, Canada, Europe. We have a few investments elsewhere. We have one investment based out of Tel Aviv. And so we're mostly Europe and the US. I spend a lot of time focused on technology, software. I've done quite a bit in hardware-enabled software, as well as software that sells into highly regulated industries like financial services, and then a bit in go-to-market technology. But as a firm, we have a team focused on B2B technology and one focused on more consumer and payments and ad tech businesses from an internet side of the house.
Fantastic. And how long have you been with the firm now?
I've been with the firm now 3.5 years, and I've been focused on technology investment for, probably the last dozen years or so.
Wow. Well, congratulations, because I also understand you just promoted to principal.
Yes, thank you.
And so this comes out, it'll be a couple weeks in. So that's fantastic. And I presume just a testament to your commitment to venture capital investing. So it's interesting. So we're recording this early March 2026. And, you know, a lot of the articles that come across my inbox are how artificial intelligence is disrupting traditional SaaS. I would love to get your perspective. You know, probably the biggest thing that we see right now is what looks like a rotation out of public SaaS stocks, into infrastructure. I mean, I don't know that that's indicative of a wholesale reallocation or permanent reallocation out of the asset class, but yeah, I'd love to get your take.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a hot topic, the SaaSpocalypse, as people are calling it in the news. I think from a public markets perspective, the public market always overreacts in the short term and underreacts in kind of the long term. So I think today, every software stock is being painted with a similar brush where they're all being said, okay, these are the legacies, these are the have-nots. I think this year will be very telling because folks will either continue to perform and the market will then reward that, or they won't innovate fast enough and the market will, leave them where they are, or perhaps it will drop further. But what that means from a private investor perspective is not a big shift in how we think about investing. We're still focused on finding companies that are disrupting industries, they're providing more value and ROI for the services and technology they're offering than what somebody could do on their own. And we are partnering with founders that are going to stay ahead of the innovation curve throughout our hold. So that hasn't changed, but what has changed is I think we are going through a shift where there will be haves and have-nots on the transition into being AI native. There will be companies that were originally, a typical SaaS platform and do a great job adopting this new technology. There will also be folks who don't. And then there'll be a set of AI native companies that become leaders in industries that previously had, a different player that might have been at the helm. And so there's a lot of change, but that also creates a lot of opportunity. I think the market is focusing on the anxiety of like, oh my gosh, so much is changing. But the reality is, anytime there is this much change, there's equally as much opportunity. And so it's a fun time to be a tech investor. And I think the core job is the same, but the bar in which a founder has to hurdle to be successful probably has increased with this, with the technology shift.
Yeah. One of the questions I understand a lot of VCs get asked, specifically by their LP base is how do you differentiate yourself? And
Yeah.
so if we can tie that together, I would love to get your perspective of how Volition seeks to separate itself from, I don't know whose count to follow. I've heard 1,000 or 2,000 VCs in the US, but
Yes.
there's a bunch.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So there are two ways that we really differentiate from the broader growth equity realm. So, there's VC earlier stage, there's private equity doing majority. We're doing minority investment and growth equity. Within growth equity, we tend to be contrarian investors. So whatever the market is saying they hate tends to be where I spend my time thinking about, oh, maybe there could be something there. For example, if you were to go back 2 or 3 years, there are a lot of growth equity firms that would blanket statements say, we don't touch anything with hardware. We don't touch it because there's CapEx and requirements, it's messier, you got to deal with all these, international manufacturers and such. So we actually doubled down on it. We made four investments in hardware-enabled software over the last 5 years. That would be an example of kind of taking a more of a contrarian bet. The other way that we differentiate is that we are very concentrated in our portfolio. So what that means is we're not playing the power law game where we have, 40 companies in a portfolio. And so if half of them don't succeed, it doesn't really matter because the other half will, provide exceptional outcomes and make up for that. We are investing in 15, maybe 20 portfolio companies. So more diversified than a founder, but about as aligned as we could get while also having LPs be willing to have us invest their capital. And the theory behind that is the smaller number of portfolio companies we have, the more we can be helpful along the way. So we have built out resources over the last 15 years as a firm in places we've identified. No two companies are alike in how they scale, but there tends to be pain points that come up often. And so
Sure.
we have things like a recruiting team in-house, operating partners focused on go-to-market, operating partners focused on financial strategy. We have advisors that come in and invest in our funds, don't pay us management fees, and help our portfolio companies as kind of a trade-off. And then, of course, there's, the partner on your board, which Candidly, making sure you like the partner you're investing in and there's a good open relationship there is critical because it is typically longer than a marriage, on an average basis that you'll have an investor on your cap table. So those are the ways we kind of think about differentiating ourselves, concentrated, contrarian, and just trying to be good people and good partners.
Fantastic. So, as you're looking for founders, there's a heuristic source pick win, assist monetize. Clear on the assist monetize. How do you guys source founders? And then, what
Yep.
does the due diligence process look like leading up to a check?
Yeah, it's a great question. We have a team of awesome analysts and associates who spend pretty much all day looking for companies based on signals or based on industry theses that we have, and cold calling, sending emails, going to industry conferences to try to identify who might fit into our general spec, who has an intriguing idea, maybe in a space that we believe in, but could be a little bit more of a contrarian bet. And then I spend a lot of time on the road meeting with founders because at the end of the day, if you're going to partner with somebody, you really do need that in-person relationship. And then once, hey, a founder says, we like Volition, we're thinking about raising some capital. The process is typically once you agree on a valuation and terms, 30 days to close, where we're doing confirmatory diligence. But more importantly, we're trying to get up to speed on the business so that we can be helpful post-close. We need to understand each functional area, along with validating that the company is real and doing some of that third-party work. But that generally is the process. And then at the end of the day, our hope is that we're playing back just as much information to the founding team so that it can be useful along the way to see their business in an outside lens that they don't really have the opportunity to do when you're on the day-to-day grind. And then that way it sets us up well for really being partners through and through for the rest of our time as investors.
Were you guys lead rounds?
We do. We always lead rounds. Yep. We're minority investors, but we lead the minority round, which sometimes is a mouthful.
Excellent. And how often will you guys co-invest, if at all?
We co-invest on rare occasion. We typically look to partner ourselves, but of course, when folks have investors already on their cap table, they can take the pro rata, that's absolutely fine. And in certain cases, it makes a lot of sense to bring in a co-investor who maybe they have certain industry connections, or in some cases, maybe it's a check that's slightly bigger than we'll write out of our fund, but we could partner with somebody else who has value-added resources or industry knowledge and connections, and the founding team thinks will be helpful in the next phase of the journey.
Which fund number is Volition on now?
Yeah, so we're in Fund Five. The firm actually spun out of Fidelity during 2009, kind of after the financial crisis. It was a great time to be investing in software because cloud was coming to the
Sure.
forefront. But Fidelity was in a financial services sector. It was an odd time to be making big growth equity investments as a company. And so we spun out. Fidelity was originally one of our investors. Now they're one of many, and we're in our fifth fund.
Fantastic. And is it always been growth equity?
It's always been growth equity, same stage, same strategy, same thesis the whole way through. So the check size has increased a bit. So that means, we tend to own a little bit more of the company than we once did, but still staying in that minority range and backing founders that are usually, say, north of 4 or 5 million in ARR, somewhere between that and 25, where there's a lot of wood to still chop. But the company has some really good basis to go off of.
What have the conversations been like inside Volition about becoming multi-stage?
Yeah, we are focused on staying in our core strategy. So I think a lot of firms fall into the trap of they're really good at a certain stage. That's why they raise funds, that's why they raise multiple funds. But then, because they raise such large funds, they have to start to think about, okay, now we're actually edging into buyout territory because we have to put in 150 million, 200 million a check in order to make this work. Our goal is to stay in our current strategy, and to raise funds that are kind of according to that. We do invest in follow-ons with our portfolio companies, so that doesn't mean that, if one of our companies is 100 million in ARR and looking to raise some capital, we might participate and another firm might come in, but our focus is not necessarily to shift our core strategy on initial investment.
In any given fund, how much are you setting aside for follow-ons, and how often will maybe you'll put together a separate SPV
Yeah, so
if
we usually set aside 20%, 25% of our fund for follow-ons. We also have a side vehicle fund, a $200 million fund, in addition to our core fifth fund that can invest across all of our funds and do follow-on investments where it makes sense. So there's a little bit of extra juice.
Fantastic. Pivoting, would love to know your career progression and what it looked like leading up to joining Volition.
Yeah. So I went to school at Babson College, which is an entrepreneurial school. It was kind of a no-name school when I went there. I feel like it's gotten more hype since. It's kind of like buying a house in a bad neighborhood that becomes fancy. But it was a great experience and it was very focused on startups. So in undergrad, I did internships at three or four different startups, all in SaaS, because that was really what was coming up and about, 2014, like that was the hot topic. And I really loved that industry. I kind of fell in love with technology. I fell in love with this subscription component and this next gen cloud component. But I found that at the startups, I was given opportunities for jobs and it was, make up your own title. Because this is back when, ping pong tables were in every room and everybody got catered lunch and things like that. And I said, heck, I don't know anything about business. I was an undergrad. And so I kind of pivoted and I said, I want to stay in software. I want to stay in this cloud world, but I want to learn about what it looks like when somebody's succeeded and built this business. And so I moved and decided to go into investment banking where we were representing software companies that were at the place where they were selling themselves, maybe going public, maybe going to a private equity firm, maybe to strategic. I spent 3 years doing that, kind of seeing what different investors look for, what best of breed is, and then ended up working on the other side of a transaction with a growth equity firm and built kind of a relationship with one of the investors. Her name's Caitlin Vorlachek. She's a good mentor of mine. She's at another firm now. And she said, man, like, wouldn't you love to be on this side where you get to be a part of the journey instead of just seeing the end? And I said, man, that sounds cool. So I ended up joining the firm called Summit Partners and did the sourcing role where you're cold calling and outreaching to founders. You're building investment theses from the ground up on what you're seeing from these conversations. And then moved to Volition from there. Summit is a big growth equity firm. Summit and TA were the two kind of first growth equity firms to create this category. And they had a smaller fund I participated in. That was where I was investing out of. That was about $1 billion, writing checks. Very similar to what Volition writes now. They got rid of that fund to focus on their $8 billion flagship fund, writing really big checks. And that wasn't really where my heart was. I love a business that's, between 5 and 20 million. There's so much to do. And it's a really fun phase as a founder because I feel like you need actually some help sometimes from somebody who's seen it before. You don't just need a few introductions, you need help on the scaling piece of that phase. And so I was really attracted to staying in that realm and joined Volition when we were in our fourth fund. So exciting. It's been an exciting ride. I've been able to partner with six portfolio companies now that we've led investments in and see them start to scale into this next stage of growth.
Bunch of questions. I'll start at the beginning. I'm curious, do you recall if Babson had set up the internships, or did you just was there some other influence that pushed you towards joining a software company?
Yeah, so Babson actually has a program where your freshman year you can get an unpaid internship and they'll pay you. So
Sure.
you have to apply to it, you get approved. But I did that my first year, and then one internship kind of begot another internship. I worked with wonderful guy Brian Rogers. Shout out to Brian, who was at a company called Evergage, and that was acquired by Salesforce actually a few years ago. But he moved to Litmus, another software company, and kind of brought me along. And so I bounced around in the Boston community within the startup scene.
And so, for the current college students or recent grads in the audience, what advice would you give them based on your experience that time?
Yeah. The best advice I was ever given that I'll pass on is when you're applying to a role, you want to be focused on sharing what you could do for that firm. So, giving ideas, coming up with ideas on how you could be impactful and focusing on that rather than focusing on a specific internship that may exist. Because I can tell you, none of my internships were programs. They were two early stage companies, but I had worked at, a marketing agency one summer, and I said, "Hey, I could help you with SEO. I could write blog posts. I could help with Google Analytics." And, then I started that internship. I learned a whole bunch of new skills that I could then bring into the following internship. And I think it's a really about do anything you can to build something you're good at right now, AI. You should be taking advantage. These technology shifts, they favor the young, right? And you're probably taking classes at this point about a topic that a whole bunch of people are just scrambling to figure out. And so if I were a college student right now, I'd be reaching out to whatever I wanted to work for and saying, "Hey, I'm really good at Claude agents. Here are some of the projects I've built. You can send them the projects that might be hosted or apps, and say, I could do this for you," and show them you can provide them value in addition to just, applying for whatever programs might be at your career fair.
Curious, do you, what's your opinion? Does AI eventually eliminate the need for a college degree?
That's an interesting prospect. My view is that we learn a lot in college beyond just the classroom. I think we learn a lot about broader topics like how do economics work, not just skills for your first job in the workplace. So I think personally, I think there's still a lot of value in a college degree. I do believe that college degrees will need to be more focused on driving ROI. I think that's actually why Babson has been elevated as a school and been a topic of conversation because it's very focused on helping you figure out your career path, helping you take classes that are relevant to that career path, in addition to the liberal arts pieces that will be important to just becoming a good human in society. But I think it will need to be, it's not just you get a college degree to get a college degree, you get a college degree to get a job. And so I think there's a little bit of a balance. If folks are really go-getters, I think you can absolutely educate yourself via AI. The technology is there. Do I think that every person who has a college degree would have done that themselves if they were not put through the process? No. So I think there will still be value there, above and beyond just the skill set.
Moving on to back to investment banking, I've found myself in conversations where people are critical of it, and I suspect it's
Yeah.
because it's very transactional in nature. But I'm gonna ask you to say something positive or constructive of your time.
Yeah. I would say that the thing I learned in investment banking that has been invaluable is nobody can work harder than I can. You work long hours in investment banking. A big piece of that is not because people want to be jerks. It's because you are a professional services firm. So you have clients. You are at your client's disposal. And that means if your clients say, "Hey, I want to see the information memorandum Friday," you got to get it done by Friday because you are a services firm. And anytime you are, that happens. And I think working, there were weeks that I worked 120 hours in a week, and Now that I don't work 120 hours a week, thank goodness, I don't think I would be alive any longer. I just know that if I needed to get something done, you can do a lot more than you realize. Like there's a quote that's, if everybody did all the things that we were capable of, we would astound ourselves. And I think that that is very accurate. And if I learned hard skills, I learned quantitative skills, I learned skills that will be redundant, like Excel and PowerPoint. Not going to matter in 5 years, but we're very helpful in the first 10 years of my career. And I think the piece that I'll really take from that is like you can outwork anybody, and there's a lot of value in having that grit.
I would tend to agree. Sometimes you don't know what you don't know, and if you find yourself in an environment like that, you can very quickly get a great education of what you're doing. I agree. So now Summit and then Volition, and so I'd love to know, you must have formed opinions of what, or done some pattern recognition of what successful founders look like. What's your opinion there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think a successful founder is incredibly passionate about the problem that they're solving. I'm not a big believer in founders that kind of just pick a random industry and say, I can build it. I love founders that have experienced the problem themselves and maybe augmented that. Maybe they have a technical founder to augment that, or maybe they are technical and they how happen to feel the problem themselves. But I think you have to have a really good feeling on that market fit before you actually even build the product. And when you have that, what it results in is a your chances of failing are lower because you know that there's market fit. You just have to build a great product versus saying, I'm going to build something and then see if it fits anywhere, see if I can convince people to purchase it by spending enough in marketing or whatever. So I think that's important. The other critical piece of a founder is their ability to recognize what they are great at and what they're not great at. In the beginning, a founder has to do everything. Whether you are a sales expert or not, you need to sell because there's nobody else to do it. But I think the best founders, as they start to get larger, they recognize what is special about them, and then they augment themselves with people around them that they really trust and they empower to own different sectors, of the business. Where people fail is typically when they try to almost control too much, and you end up being adequate at everything instead of special at everything. And that is a big lesson that typically happens, candidly, when we're invested, because founders are usually, founder-led sales, maybe until we're involved and they're building out a sales team, a marketing team. Maybe they finally have capital to build out the real product team that they wanted. And so learning to delegate but keep what you're really good at is really critical to a founder.
Do you think that's habit, or do you think that it's just the nature of successful founders to want to make sure their fingerprints are on everything?
I think it's hard for most founders to let go of having their fingerprints on everything. It takes a lot of self-awareness, and it takes, back to my original statement, the passion for the problem. Like really wanting to solve that problem instead of just focusing on, oh, I want to build a business and make, $20 million or whatever it is that your number is you're trying to make from building that business. And I think if you really focus on the problem, then you naturally start to want to bring in folks who can do XYZ better than you can, and spend all your time on the piece that differentiates you as a founder and that you can provide value to solve that problem sooner.
I love it. Looking ahead, what do you see on the horizon for the asset class?
Yeah, it's an interesting time. I think growth equity is actually in a good place as an asset class because in venture over the last few years, just as there is every time there's a big tech refresh, there will be a lot of companies that fall to the wayside. I think the loss rates in companies that are early stage will be higher than they have been over the last 10 years, just like they were after the dot-com boom. And then if I think about private equity, there tends to be a lot of debt use. And I think that given the anxiety in the market, it will be harder to get debt facilities if you have balloon payments coming up to replace, and that will actually increase the loss rate for the private equity firms. And so growth equity is somewhere in between where there's not a lot of debt. The companies are big enough that they had to be some product market fit, and they have enough resources to maybe make the pivot if they are not AI native to start. If you think about a company with 20 million of revenue coming in the door, that's 20 million of cash you could use to fund a whole lot of innovation that, if you were zero in revenue and pivoting would be a lot harder to do. And so I think growth equity is in kind of a unique place. And I wish I could say I could have predicted that when I chose growth equity, but that's not usually how life works. But I am bullish on the overall category.
Okay. Unfortunately, we're close to wrapping up. But before we do, love to ask a retrospective question on just as you reflect back on the entire journey so far. What would you share with your younger self if you had a chance to have that conversation?
Yeah. If I were to go back and have a conversation with myself, I probably would tell myself to be less risk averse and take more bets along the way in categories that seemed crazy at the time. I wish I could go back and think of the first time somebody told me about, Bitcoin, for example. I was like, that seems fake. I probably would be on a private island somewhere, but and the reality is that when you're young, you don't really have anything besides yourself to bank on. Like you don't really need to worry so much about risk because I firmly believe you kind of, as long as you keep yourself healthy as a human and you don't burn personal relationships, I don't think you can really mess up in your 20s. And so I wish I kind of allowed myself to make more bets, more risks for mistakes in my 20s because I think I've learned the most from those things, and if I could have more lessons, that would be better than less. So I would go back and kind of adjust that.
It's interesting. One of the things you referenced Bitcoin, and I'd be curious to know if you ever do this. How I've done a similar exercise, and so I constantly look around me today, and I go, what is something that it's very easy to dismiss, but maybe it's a mistake to do so because it's like beginning stages of the next Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Do you ever do any or have any exercises like that? When you're trying to
Yeah.
figure out, where the growth equity returns are going to be tomorrow.
You have described Volition's strategy of being a contrarian investor. So we're always looking at, what if I have a call with somebody and I say, oh, I don't like this because of whatever. Maybe there's exposure in some area that's very easy to say. Everybody hates exposure. I'll catch myself and I'll say, do I really believe that? Or is that just what other people have told me? And if I can't actually logic my way through why that is, or say, is that really a risk I'm not willing to take? Then I double click and I say, I'm gonna take out that opinion and let's start from scratch. Because I think it's funny, we did an exercise where we all reached out to folks we had, connections, friends that work at other firms, and we asked them, what industries are you not touching right now? Like, you can't bring it to investment committee. Like, you just can't touch it. And had them listed out. And then we basically spent the next 2 years thinking about those sectors because, yes, there's probably a reason that people said they don't want to spend time there, but there are also going to be exceptions to that rule within that broader swath. And so I think that's where a lot of opportunity can lie as a growth equity investor.
I mean, it makes good sense. I guess but therein lies the skill of the investor, to be able to say, hey, this is a typewriter,
Right.
versus this is the next big thing.
Yeah.
I'll be curious. So, I heard references to mentors along the ways. And so early on, did you actively seek them out? Did it just happen? How did you find people to give you share their wisdom with you?
Yeah, I would say I've had many mentors. I think that When I was younger, I always thought, oh, I need to find one mentor to, guide me through everything. I think it's about trying to build real relationships with the people you work with and be open to learning. And you may have different mentors at different junctures of life. I had a great mentor in undergrad at the startups that I mentioned, Brian Rogers. I had a great mentor when I was in investment banking, Rahul Swani, who kind of challenged me to get the quantitative skills that I think I did ultimately need for what I do now. I had a great mentors at Summit who taught me the asset class, Tom Jennings, Steve Toomey, Caitlin Vorlichek, who brought me in originally to the asset class. And then I have great mentors here at Volition now. And I think I try to keep in touch with all of my mentors. And sometimes that's easier said than done. But I don't think the theory of needing to find one mentor in order to make it is true. I think you can have many, and that can be just as valuable.
And what's your opinion on what those relationships are like? Do you find they're it's a lot of give and take, or is it just, hey, I'm just going to listen to hear what you have to say because my cup is empty?
I think it is being open to listening that's critical. But at the end of the day, people love human connection. And I think it's also about finding people you enjoy and that enjoy you. And you might have several bosses, one of them you may naturally get along with better. Like, that's a great person to choose as your mentor because they're going to enjoy spending time maybe with you, and you're going to enjoy spending time with them. And because in your 20s, you're so young and you are kind of a blank slate, like you'll just naturally sponge and learn. I think when people try to create mentor relationships that are too polished and professional, it takes away some of that natural relationship. And it's hard to fake that, right? It's hard to really get the value out of a mentorship relationship and unless you have some real understanding of them as a person and a real like friendship as well.
I agree, and I think it's very insightful. And I maybe sometimes too, depending on the gap in career, it could be easy to, put them on a pedestal and by consequence not get to really know them at a personal level.
No, that's a great point. I mean, as I manage analysts and associates, I usually have them like come over to my house, meet my husband, we have dinner, because I think it's important for them to see like I'm also a human and I will also be making mistakes. So, if I am direct in my feedback or something when we're in a tight deadline, you're more likely to give a benefit of the doubt and stay with a positive attitude than if you don't really know somebody as a human and they just feel like this person who's kind of directing you along.
I'm curious, what counsel would you give someone who found themselves in what would everyone would agree is a great opportunity, but maybe it's a toxic environment?
I think that you need to make sure you're prioritizing your health. If you are in a truly toxic environment, I don't think there's any amount of, professional experience you could be getting that's fully worth it. So there is a line, and you should know what the line is. I do think that it's easier when you're younger to kind of put on the tough skin because you don't feel like there's as many alternatives, which may be good, may be bad. But I would keep your eye on, what that line is to you and don't let folks cross it. Flip side is I think it's easier to work a lot harder when you're younger. So I always thought about it like I'm doing this now so that I don't have to do it later. And I would say that, the efforts and the rewards have been there, at least for me in my career. I still work hard, but I'm not working 100 hours a week anymore, thank goodness. So it is a bit of a balance, but if it's truly toxic, I'd say get out of there. There's probably not enough learnings available to make it worthwhile.
Well, I think that's great counsel. And I think that a lot of times, you got someone who thinks, oh, I just need this job or this opportunity is too great. not realizing is a lot of times, we make our own opportunity. So I would
Yeah.
agree. This far in, I don't, time is too precious. Yeah, respect is, it's also a two-way street, I found. If you
Yes.
don't respect yourself, no one's going to respect you. So, yeah.
Absolutely. The other thing I would add is early in your career, I always thought, like, if I don't have this boss as a reference, like my career is over. People don't think about you as much as you think they think about
That's
you. So,
true.
like, one, if you have one boss that, wouldn't give you a good reference, it's not going to ruin your career. Just give a different reference or something like that.
No retirement for you. That's funny.
Yeah.
Before we wrap up, you mentioned a whole host of people, but yeah, I would, just really want to make sure that extends you an opportunity to recognize anyone personally or professionally, who's had a positive impact, on you over the years.
Yeah, I mean, I think I named a lot of names, and there's infinite more. Probably a biggest shout out would go to honestly my parents. Like my parents always pushed me to do whatever I wanted to do. They didn't force me into like a finance role because it's high paying. They let me go after whatever it was that I was interested in, and I think as a result, I have a really fun job where I get to work with founders all the time and learn about new problems they're solving in different ways and basically talk to folks about whatever they're the most passionate about, their baby, their business all day long. So, it's probably the best job you could get.
That's great. I love it. Well, a tremendous amount of insights. Melanie, really appreciate your time. If there's anyone in our audience that'd like to get a hold of you, learn more about Volition, how can they find you?
So they can find me on LinkedIn, Melanie Nabar, or my email is melanien@volitioncapital.com. You can probably find it on our website as well if you look up Volition.
Fantastic. Melanie, I thank you. Appreciate you sharing your perspective and insights. This was really awesome, and invaluable.
Thanks so much. It was great discussion.
Yeah, and again, for the benefit of our audience, Melanie Nabar, principal at Volition Capital. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. Take care. Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com/podcast-guest. If you've got something out of this interview, please share this episode on social media. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.